Coming up next on This Week in Computer Hardware, Kepler NVIDIA's 680 GTX is here. Ultrabook Gaming, check out the Acer Aspire Timeline Ultra M3. It's mobile Kepler. 60 terabyte hard drives. Hammer means laser-powered hard drives. Think terabits per inch. A super-powered home server and why Raspberry Pi sucks. It's all coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 162, recorded March 22nd, 2012. The GTX 680 is here.
This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. All streamed directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to netflix.com/twit.
Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware. I'm Patrick Norton. This is the show where we bring you the most exciting and most engaging news in PC, Mac, and, well, pretty much any other hardware we get excited about that involves computing. Joining me, as always, Mr. Ryan Shrout. I'm not going to ask him how the basketball thing is going, but I am going to ask him how excited he is for today to finally be here. We know why. I think we can comfortably say we know why TSMC's 28-nanometer line was down for the last couple weeks. Kepler has arrived.
Yep. That's right. It's been a long time coming. Like, for some reason, you know, we did the 7900 card launches, we did the 7800 card launches and the 77s and that kind of stuff. This seemed more hectic. NVIDIA actually did a pretty good job of coming up with kind of new, interesting, kind of unique features, as well as just kind of doing the normal performance testing and that kind of stuff. So I actually think it turned out to be a pretty good overall product. And before we talk about it, I did just get this in. UPS just delivered this about an hour ago, so I got my first retail sample as well. So I was planning on doing this tonight, but I'm really tired. So probably tomorrow morning now, we're going to do some SLI testing. Maybe we'll stream that as well, but try to do some interesting stuff there with that. So yeah, you want to talk about Kepler and all of its goodness, I guess?
I think we have to. That's obviously the big story. I think what we're looking at is, where does it sit in the universe? I want to say, hard OCP hooked it up to four monitors simultaneously. Inquirer says it's not as fast as like the 7970 or the much. What was it? Let me see if I can find that quote. Rates places the performance of the GTX 680 as lower than a 7870, let alone the 7970. But where should we start this, right? Okay, I'm quoting the line. This is the Inquirer's opinion. I'm not saying it's my opinion. I'm not saying it's your opinion. I'm not saying it's Twitch's opinion. But it's crazy, right? PCPro.com, how do you stop the GTX 680 leaks? Release the card, they go away. But so we know it's on TSMC's 28-nanometer process, 3.54 billion transistors, GPU, 1,536 CUDA cores running at 1.006 gigahertz, 2 gigs of memory running at 6 gigahertz on a healthy 256-bit bus.
What's interesting about that is... Oh, I was just going to say, a lot of people kind of attached to the shader clock difference, the CUDA core difference. Huh? The GTX 580 card had 512 cores, whereas the GTX 680, the new card, has 1,536 cores. So it has three times as many CUDA cores, right? So you might assume, well, it's going to be three times as fast, or it's going to be three times as much computing power, and that is not the case. Because remember how we used to talk? It was always kind of confusing. There were two clock speeds on an NVIDIA GPU. There was the base clock and there was the shader clock, and they're essentially a multiple of two from each other. That whole configuration of things is gone. The base clock of a GTX 580 is 1,006 megahertz, and the shaders run at the exact same. 1,006 megahertz. So there's no kind of doubling up of anything in that way. So, you know, you're tripling the number of cores, but you are essentially lowering the clock speed a certain amount by, you know, maybe taking it from 1,600 megahertz down to 1,000 megahertz. So you're not going to get triple the performance of a 580. I just thought that was important for people to realize. And in fact, if you go to like, I think Newegg still lists some of the cards this way. They still list them as having like a 2012 megahertz shader clock, which is patently incorrect. It is lying to the consumer. I don't know if that's the vendors themselves putting the wrong specs in the system or if that's Newegg.
Let's call it terrible confusion in the early days of the online sales. Somebody cut and paste, something gets foobarred. But so, okay, triple the performance, not there. But yes, it is competing with the Radeon HD 7970, 7950, 7800, 7700. It should be healthily above those. Are we talking about neck and neck with the 7970, or are we talking about a whooping here?
I would say it's actually a healthy jump past the 7970. We test 6 games, 2 synthetic benchmarks and power and that kind of stuff. Of our 6 games, 4 of them were healthy wins, which I would consider, 12, 15, 20% performance advantages for the GTX 680. And that's pretty substantial. One game, you had like a 10 to 12% advantage back to the AMD card, and one game was a tie. So overall, I'd say the GTX 680, I think it's a surprise to most of the people in the hardware world, even the editors and reviewers like myself, getting briefed on all this technology and all this hardware. I was surprised to see the 680 be this much faster than the 7970. It's not world-changing, but I expected it to be pretty close, maybe 5% better in some games and 5 to 10% worse in some games. But it seems to me to be a healthy majority ahead, and a lot of the articles and other quotes I've seen have agreed with that sentiment, that it is surprising, not just faster, but it was surprisingly fast.
So, which benchmark would you like to start with? I mean, I'm looking at Batman Arkham City physics disabled chart right now, and it's pretty interesting. You're looking at GTX 680, 2 gigs, minimum frames per second, 35, maximum frames per second, 155, averaging 112. The Radeon 7970, we're looking at, it bottoms out at 51 frames per second, tops at 132, averages 100.6. So when we're looking at a benchmark like that, should we be looking at more at the average or the peak, or avoiding sort of the bottom end there? I mean, it's also kind of amazing. I was going to say also looking at the jump over the GTX 580 is really impressive, going from 85 to 112 on average. That's a healthy jump.
It's a good card. I would say, ignore the high end, look more towards the average and the minimum, because you want the minimums to not be too low. And then that's why we include the frame rate over time as well, so you can see if there's any kind of odd dips in performance and that kind of stuff that maybe don't throw off the average as much as it should, but would affect things. We didn't see any real anomalies with this particular hardware review. So I think in general, the performance is impressive, and the new features that they offer are actually pretty substantially unique to the GPU world thus far as well. You mentioned in the show notes we've got down here the GPU boost. This is something, the easiest analogy is if we've already explained Turbo Boost to you, Intel Turbo Boost to you on Intel CPUs. It's a very similar idea to what they've done with the GPU here. Now, Tom Peterson from NVIDIA was actually on our show earlier today, our live review of the GTX 680. We had some slides and stuff, and he did a really good explanation of what GPU Boost is. The quick summary of it is, if you go to that page in our review, you'll see a couple of graphs there, bar graphs. GPU clocks are traditionally set in that the clock speed of the GPU had to be based on the thermal envelope with the game that used the most power, right? So you would take an application like 3D Mark 11 that used a lot of power. You said, well, this card is going to be designed for 200 watts or whatever it is. So we just put the clock speeds up to where it hits 200 watts there. And that seems great and everything, and that's how GPUs have been done. But the problem is, if you look at a game like Battlefield 3, maybe at that clock speed, it's only using 180 watts of power. So there's this gap that NVIDIA called the, I can't remember what they call it, but the room for growth or potential expansion there, and boost capability, I think is what they called it. And so you had 20 watts more, maybe 30, maybe 40 watts, depending on the title, of additional thermal headroom that you could use that the GPU is capable of running at, that the thermal capabilities of the cooler on the card are capable of running at, that the power is capable of being supplied to the graphics card as well. But the only thing that needs to change is that GPU clock and maybe the voltage as well. So GPU boost dynamically adjusts the clock speed and the voltage of the GPU, and as well as the memory, but to a lesser degree, to try to stabilize how much power each game uses no matter the game. So you might run at 1,050 megahertz in 3D Mark 11, but you might run at 1,150 megahertz in Battlefield 3. So you're getting a little bit of extra clock speed, which is going to give you, you know, the best overall kind of game experience.
It's essentially self-overclocking on the fly. I mean, it just is, to oversimplify it.
The interesting thing was they were very careful not to want to call it overclocking because it's...
How about this?
It uses above a certain limit.
It uses technologies normally associated with overclocking, adjusting the clock speed and the voltage, doing it itself to sort of maximize the performance for wattage or to keep the wattage down as much as possible for a given level of performance.
The goal, I would say, is to, given a wattage that they target, 200 watts, 250 watts, to get the most performance possible per game, per individual game. And that's what I think really makes it interesting. It's not a driver thing. It's not a profile thing. It's all in the hardware. And if a game like Batman Arkham City is bottlenecked by something else, not the clock speed, it'll change things around so that it has room to grow inside that thermal envelope. So it's actually a pretty interesting technology. Now, there's concern that this will introduce some variability into the market. It means that the 680 that I buy and the 680 that you buy could perform slightly different due to variations in silicon and thermal properties of each chip as it comes off the line. And I've only gotten one card, so I really can't test that variance. We've got our second card in today, but it's going to take a couple of hundred of these to really kind of see that variance. And NVIDIA has that information. They're not real eager to share it, but they're saying 2-3% variance from kind of the best cards to the worst cards on average, what they're expecting. So fairly minimal.
But we're also talking about a possibility that if you have an inferior cooling environment, or if you're in Phoenix in August, your performance is going to be lower with this GPU than if you're in Phoenix in December. The idea the better the cooling design is, the better the airflow through the case, the lower the ambient temperature in the room, the better your performance with these cards are going to be.
And so if you have an open air design like we tend to test our things on versus in a case design versus in a poorly cooled and poorly circulated case, you might see different results. And I think there will be some facet of the consumer that doesn't like that variability. AMD was kind of doing their cold calls the day before launches, as tends to happen with both of these companies, saying, we guarantee that all cards will perform at the same performance no matter what system they're in within these tolerances and blah, blah, blah. And there's validity to that, and there's credit to that, that there will be variances from card to card, from user to user, depending on the system and depending on the silicon that you get and all that kind of stuff. And even depending on what kind of add-in card vendor might add onto their system, right? So there's a lot more that's going to go into it. But it's going to make reviewers' job a little bit more complicated because now we have to take into account all these different types of things. For the first outset, like this GeForce card, it's a reference cooler. There's not going to be anything that really is going to change on it. So we'll be able to run our testing, see if we have any variance there. What is the clock speed we get when we run Battlefield 3 on the reference card versus what is the clock speed we get on Battlefield 3 when we run it on this Galaxy card? What kind of changes are we going to see in that kind of way? So they actually had a lot of other cool features. We don't need to dive into too much, I guess. Adaptive VSync, frame rate limiting. Both of these are software features that you can enable through, the individual tools from EVGA and MSI and ASUS and those guys that actually do really cool things that nobody has really seen before. Frame rate limiting is great if you play old games and you don't want to necessarily need 200 frames per second. In Left 4 Dead 2, for example, but you still want to play the game, you frame limit it at 80 frames per second. It only renders 80 frames per second, and you get power savings because of that. In our testing, Deus Ex used like 45 or 50 watts less power when we frame limited it to 80 frames per second versus just letting it go all the way out. So there's some cool things that they've done in here besides just improve the hardware and the performance.
So we get into the whole sort of what's going on with fast approximate anti-aliasing. Have they finally gotten to the point where it doesn't require the developer to do any additional work to integrate FXAA, or is that still requiring some effort on the developers?
Okay. They're telling us almost all games will be able to enable FXAA, fast approximate anti-aliasing, in the control panel, but there is a performance penalty, but it's basically you don't get as much of a performance benefit when FXAA is enabled in the control panel versus when it is enabled directly in the game. If the developer includes it in the game specifically, it is a much more efficient process than when NVIDIA kind of hacks it on, slaps it on at the mm-hmm. end of the process.
Right.
And it's still better than 4XAA, 4XMSAA, right? But it's not going to be as cool a feature as it is when you can enable it directly, like in Battlefield 3 or in Deus Ex and those other types of games. It's still pretty cool. And they also announced TXAA, which I think stands for temporal anti-aliasing. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I guess the X doesn't stand for anything. But this is a new technology that they're claiming will do, you know, the image quality of 8XAA for the performance cost of 2XAA.
Right.
But this is also another instance where it has to be implemented by the developer in the engine to begin with. But they had a pretty good list of those companies. The Unreal Engine 4 is going to have it. And once you go from there, it's pretty much everybody, right? So it could be interesting addition, but it was one of those things we just kind of included in there. But it's not really a benefit to gamers today, and I don't know if it will be a benefit to gamers really in 2012 to any kind of major degree.
And in terms of the power consumption on this, are we looking at something like 15 watts at idle? It seems to scale down really nicely when you're not touching the 3D or you know, doing minimal work with 3D on the computer.
It scales pretty well at idle, not as well as the mm-hmm. AMD cards. It doesn't. Okay. It doesn't. The AMD cards still have this zero core technology that basically allows the GPU to almost turn off completely when the screen actually goes to sleep mode. The idle power is a little bit better on the AMD cards, maybe 10 watts or something like that. Not a huge, mm-hmm. not a huge amount. What is interesting to me when you talk about power consumption with the GTX 680 is that the GTX 680 uses less power under a full load than the HD 7970 does while outperforming it. And that's not entirely unusual for processors or graphics processors, but I think a lot of people have made this comment. We've never seen that from NVIDIA before. They are usually the progenitors of the large, hot chip. It's fast, but it's large and it's hot. And in this case, they built a smaller, more power efficient, and better performing GPU than AMD did. And it's a pretty impressive feat to be able to do all three of those things in one whack.
One of the things that was really interesting about Kepler is that, oddly enough, along with the desktop part, a mobile part came out today, the Acer Aspire Timeline Ultra M3, which there's a couple of interesting things going on. It's probably certainly the first one I've seen 15-inch Ultrabook, which is something that Intel promised at CES. But not only is it a Core i5 Ultrabook, it's actually running the mobile version of the Kepler GPU, which is a really interesting idea where you've got a 15.6-inch Ultrabook, which means fairly thin, fairly light, 5 pounds in weight, packing. Yeah, okay, we could use a little more cheap, you know, RAM because it's only got 4 gigs of RAM running in there. But you're talking mm-hmm. about gaming performance in a 5 pound box that should be selling for very close to $800 or $900.
Yeah, it's odd to see the desktop and the notebook kind of released at the same time. And this really isn't the full notebook release. But Acer was going to sell this notebook apparently regardless of what NVIDIA said. So they decided they would go ahead and launch the product. SKU is the GT640M. And when it's a Kepler design, but it's not a it's not a super high end GPU. This GPU has 384 cores compared to the desktop part we're talking about that has 1500. So there's a dramatic performance difference, but you take that same power efficiency discussion that we just had on the desktop, it's way more important on the notebook side, right? I think that's where they really made their design commitment was they could get away with making big hot chips on the desktop cards, but they can't get away with making big hot chips on the mobile side.
At least if they want to actually have any design wins.
Right.
I think it's funny. I think we'll see more of the 640 parts when Ivy Bridge is released later. Well, actually, we should probably briefly mention we have a launch date for Ivy Bridge. That's going to be March 23rd. Do we expect the desktop and the notebook parts on the 23rd, or just the notebook parts?
To be completely honest with you, and usually I just say I don't know anything about it. I don't know anything about the date of March 23rd. I do not believe that this is a correct assumption. Maybe they're going to launch a couple of notebooks on the March 23rd and kind of announce them or something like that. But as far as component parts, like parts you'll be able to buy and build a system in, I don't think we're talking about March 23rd as anything specific. Or
I should point out there was truth.
Intel just decided not to tell me anything about it, which
I doubt. Guru 3D is basically claiming that March 23rd is the launch date and then April 29th.
I'd heard that in a couple places, people mentioning that specific date. I just don't know exactly what it was referring to. There was one other thing I wanted to ask about the mobile stuff on the Kepler side. You know, the specific Acer Spire M3 notebook is not a great machine. It has some design issues. It has a flimsy screen. It has a power button that you can accidentally hit fairly easily, which I think is just beyond me. What is your thought? So when NVIDIA brought their mobile people out for their Editor's Day, they were more like, here's what we can do in an Ultrabook. We can put a discrete GPU in Ultrabook. You can play Battlefield 3 at 720p or 1366 by 768 resolutions and higher at ultra settings in an Ultrabook, and you get with Optimus and that kind of technology, you get the full battery life that you would without it. What are your thoughts on the validity or the use case of a discrete GPU in something like an Ultrabook?
I think it's an area. As often as we get requests for people that want to buy notebooks that can do gaming, the idea of a sub-$1,000 notebook that can provide decent gaming performance, I think there's a huge market for that. I think currently, the gaming market is traditionally, if you're lucky, it's a $1,500 notebook. More often, it's a $2,000 notebook. Often, it has atrocious battery life. Often, it's the size of the recently discontinued Encyclopedia Britannica, at least a volume of it. So I think it's a brave new world that both Intel and NVIDIA would like to see start to get serious. I think there's a market there for it. I think if people have an option between buying a notebook that'll do gaming and a notebook that won't, or a laptop that'll do gaming and a laptop that won't, they'll definitely take advantage of that.
Cool.
Yeah. We wait to see with bated breath. We had some questions about, have you any time to play around with overclocking, to look at that between the 7970 and the 680?
So the 7970 overclocks like a graphics card that you would normally see. You adjust the clock. You can adjust the voltage if you have the software capable to do that, and it's a static clock.
Right.
With GPU boost, overclocking works pretty differently on the 680, in that your GPU clock speed is always within a range anyway, even at its default setting. Its base clock is 1,006 megahertz, but it could scale up to 1,100 megahertz depending on, even 1,150 depending on the game and the power consumption that it's using. When you overclock the NVIDIA GTX 680, there's actually two bars you adjust. Power target, as a percentage, right? So the base power consumption is 195 watts. You can adjust that up to 250 watts. You can push more power into this card at the expense of heat, noise, and that kind of stuff. And you can, if you do that, you're giving the card permission to go over 195 watts. And then you can adjust the GPU clock offset, which basically takes that range of clock speeds that GPU boost enables and just shifts it up. So if you add 100 megahertz clock offset, now your new base clock is going to be 1100 megahertz, and you can scale up to 1250 or 1300. If you add 200 megahertz offset, which is I wasn't able to do, your base clock is now 1200 megahertz, and you could go up to 1400 megahertz. I did see a report of somebody, one of those crazy LN2 overclockers, that was able to hit like 1.7 or 1.8 gigahertz on the 680 already. So outside the realm of the normal consumer for sure, but still interesting to see.
I should also point out to one of the people in the chat room, Zephyr, is every time I see an Ultrabook, I just imagine how fast it'll die due to all that heat in that small envelope. The nice thing about the engineering behind the MacBook Air and the Intel engineered Ultrabooks is that they have engineered some very, very effective heat management, basically thermal management inside of the device. And the processors aren't generating that much heat. So believe me, I've already spent 36 hours in a 95 degree room, basically running background operations with like 70% of my processor on a MacBook Air. And the heat's not going to kill them. Dropping them down a flight of stairs is generally what's going to kill a notebook. So... one of the nice things about the release of the GTX 680, of course, is something we always say. We tell you to wait. We tell you to wait to spend your money. Don't buy parts now and assemble a computer in 6 months. We tell you to save your money and then buy all your parts when you're ready to build the machine because prices drop. So now the GTX 580 is hitting $360. $390, $360 after the instant rebate, and Newegg will ship one actually to you for free. The EVGA Superclock GTX, yes, for free. The EVGA Superclock GTX 580, somewhere around $440. Do you think we can expect our friends at AMD to start dropping prices anytime soon, or are they going to try to hold steady for a few more weeks?
I think they'll hold steady. I think the 570s that are out there and the 580s are on their way out. There's a very limited stock left in that. What's interesting here is we often get questions about upgrading to SLI versus buying a new card. If you have a 580 or a 570 today, you can get a 570 for $250. Right. This is a great time to go get that second one and double up and get SLI performance. It's going to be right up there with a 680. And if you've already got a 580 and you want to spend another $350, $360, $70, now is a great time to get that second card to upgrade your system before they're gone forever. And you have no choice but to upgrade to the new, more expensive model.
One of the mellow rumors this week is that Google is actually rumored to be releasing a $199 Nexus tablet, or tablet, as most people would normally say it, which is an interesting concept. There's a picture up on PCPro.com from Techizer, and it's an interesting idea. It's a reference tablet, 7-inch reference tablet, sort of like a giant Google Nexus smartphone. And they think that's going to be coming out from Google as a base platform for other vendors to take a look on at design. Recent rumors, quote, suggest that an Android tablet is a done deal according to sources within Google's supply chain. The Nexus tablet will allegedly feature a 7-inch form factor, be powered by a TI UMAP 4 processor to keep costs low instead of using a Tegra 3, and run an updated version of Android, specifically Android 4.1. The Verge claims that the Nexus tablet will retail for $199 in the United States.
Sounds great to me. I hope it happens. I think something like that is kind of necessary if you really compete against the iPad directly, kind of like a hardware-software merging of things. I'm not saying cut out all the other Android partners or anything like that, but create one platform kind of like they did on the phones and leave that as like the goal for every other vendor to aspire to. So,
I'd like to see what the performance looks like.
Yeah, they're not real. I think they're saying it's using a TI OMAP 4 processor, but you never really know at this point. the last little bit of news before we get into some emails is apparently Seagate is ready to hit the 1 terabit per square inch storage mark. And this is using something called heat-assisted magnetic recording, which I really don't know much about. But when I saw that this meant the possibility of 60 terabyte hard drives, I was compelled to put it in the show notes.
Well, it's okay. So at this point, for years and years and years and years and years, for the last 5 years, 5-6 years, per particular magnetic recording has been the technology of choice to increase the aerial density or the amount of bits per square inch on a drive, right? So perpendicular magnetic recording, PMR, really cool. And that's where we're getting 2 and 3 terabyte drives from, this incredibly dense technology that once again sort of keeps magnetic recording moving forward. So very early, and I'll tell you how early in a second, very early press release from Seagate basically says that they've used HAMR, which is heat-assisted magnetic recording, to hit for the first time an aerial density of 1 terabit per square inch. That is incredibly dense. HAMR, heat-assisted magnetic recording, is essentially heating the magnetic material before the bits are encoded onto it. The idea is, and this is where it all gets really fuzzy and really into physics, but the idea that you will be able to address smaller magnetic size. Basically, a tinier chunk of magnetic material will be able to be encoded and locked in place by using this. And it's essentially lasers on a hard drive. It's a really, yeah. I mean, basically, so for years and years and years, perpendicular magnetic recording was their way of shrinking the bit size on the platter. And, quote, the key to aerial density gains is to do both without disruption to the bit's magnetization, a phenomenon that can garble data. So the idea is that by heating it before they flip the bit or basically encode that tiny little piece of real estate on the platter, it is more stable than it would be using perpendicular magnetic recording alone. So
to kind of put it in perspective, I think Alan said last night that this is essentially looking at 1 nanometer being able to store that bit, and you compare that to where we're at now on flash memory at 25 nanometer, something in that range. So we're talking about a big multiple down in terms of capacity and size. Huge. And that kind of thing. So
huge,
and hopefully that means speed will increase as well.
You're looking at like 60 terabytes. Yeah, anytime you increase the aerial density, that means you up the number of bits that sweep under the head for a given rotation of the platter, right? The denser the bits, the more bits go into the platter for a given platter speed or rotational speed. They're talking about like 60 terabyte drives in a 3.5-inch package, i.e. the equivalent of a NAS in a single drive, right? Expensive NAS right now in a single drive. But we're looking at somewhere, we're looking at reaching that over the next 10 years. So this is something, it's a really interesting idea. I think it's going to be a really interesting challenge. Essentially, they're taking sort of, they're looking at magneto-optical technology. They're looking at optical tech. Basically, they're shrinking little tiny lasers on that little tiny head that's swinging over the platter. And it's a little Rube Goldberg, but I'm really excited to see this come into play. Because the idea of having like a 60 terabyte hard drive in a computer is just obscene in a really good way. So should we take a moment to thank our friends at Netflix?
Yeah, we definitely should. we want to thank Netflix, of course, for sponsoring today's episode. If you listen to this show, you know that we love Netflix. You know all about what it offers. We're going to tell you again, because we're going to tell you until every single person signs up and gives us a try. So Netflix is a service that lets you stream TV shows and movies to basically anywhere you want to be. You can stream it on your TV. You can stream it on your TV through your gaming console, like your Xbox 360, your PlayStation 3, your Wii. You can hook up a Roku box. You can hook up an Apple TV. Check your DVD player or your Blu-ray player or even your TV. It might already have Netflix streaming support built in, in which case you are ahead of the game and ready to enjoy the service. Now, you can also watch on the go if you have an iPhone, if you have an iPad, if you have one of many Android phones. Not all Android phones, but quite a few now are supported by the Netflix streaming applications. And one of the cool things about being able to watch on the go is that you have the capability to start watching a program, whether it be a TV show or a series or a movie or whatever it is, before you leave the house. Say you start it in the morning and now you got to get on the bus and go to work or go to school or whatever it is, you can finish it on your phone and picks up right where you left off. It's a really, really cool feature. And once you use it once or twice, you will fall in love with it and you will wonder why anything else doesn't have that. And what's great with Netflix is you can watch as many movies or TV shows as you want. It's unlimited. There's no limit to the number of times you can watch an individual episode or an individual movie. You can stream them over and over again. If you have kids, you don't have to burn out your DVD player. You can just burn out the bits on the internet instead with all those cartoons that they want to watch. So we want you to try Netflix. We really like the service. We think you are going to fall in love with it. To do that, all you have to do is go to netflix.com/twit. That's important. The URL in there, /twit. You get 30 days free when you sign up. 30 days completely free to try out the service, see if you like it, make sure it's something that you want to continue to pay for. You can cancel at any time. No issues at all. Netflix.com/twit is the URL you need to go to, though, to try it out. And we want to thank Netflix for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware and the entire Twit network.
Ooh. We got a great email from Chris about Raspberry Pi. Would you like to read this one?
Hold on.
Okay.
I'll read this one, but we want to remind people, email us. Twitch, T-W-I-C-H at twit.tv. Send us your questions. Even if you don't have a question, this email that we're going to read from Chris, which was a great email, it doesn't really have a question. It's more of an informational piece to share with our readers, and it's actually really, 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 really good. So Chris is a was listening to us talk about the Raspberry Pi. We've talked about it many times on the show. It's this tiny, tiny little ARM computer that is powered by USB, essentially. It says, I'm a regular listener in Australia. I've heard you mention the Raspberry Pi several times, in particular, noting with a great what a great cheap little media center it could make, especially in XBMC, because XBMC is being ported into it. While that could easily be the case, there's a major barrier to that that you should make your listeners aware of before they rush out and buy them for that purpose. The problem is this. The Raspberry Pi SoC, the Broadcom BCM2835, has a puny ARM11 CPU, but it also has a video core for GPU with powerful hardware video decoding features that can cope with most common video formats at 1080p. Sounds great, right? Everything's going terrific. It supports it has the capability to run MPEG-2, MPEG-4, H.264, WebM, all that stuff. Perfect for a streaming player, you would think. But here's the rub. They only provide software drivers for the GPU's H.264 decoding. So that is the only format that it will currently decode. And the GPU isn't documented, the driver source code is not supplied, and the CPU is too weak to do software-based encoding, so third-party devs can't add support for other formats. This means that your Raspberry Pi home theater PC couldn't play DVDs via USB DVD drive, DVD images, DVD B-T, in most places of the world, which use MPEG-2, or your XVID or DivX media collection, and so on. To do those, you'd have to transcode everything to H.264, probably losing further video quality, and or the menus and extra features of your DVD, etc., etc. This could easily be solved by Raspberry Pi Foundation licensing the necessary extra driver blobs from Broadcom, selling them on a reasonable extra charge. $20, $30 seems ballparkish when you look at the licensing costs involved and allow for a reasonable overhead. However, they seem relatively uninterested in this, with the result that the Pi is crippled and well short of the truly amazing product that it could be for media playing purposes anyway. Hope you guys find this information useful. And I would encourage would-be Raspberry Pi media stream users to ask the foundation to urgently address the problem. And he provided a link to the Features and Requests forum at the Raspberry Pi website. So that is, does that change your opinion on things, Patrick?
Yes and no. Okay, so let's take a step back and talk about some of the issues with, a lot of people don't realize there's a group called MPEG LA, which is the consortium. It's a group that was put together to handle the licensing of basically all of there's basically, I'm trying to think about where to start this particular bag of worms, this bag of weasels. There are basically MPEG LA. They're out of Denver. They're a company that manages the patent pools because a whole bunch of companies have a whole bunch of patents related to MPEG-2, MPEG-4, IEEE 1394. Let's see. One that I didn't know, BC-1, ATSC, and AVCH.264, right? Okay. All of these patents require licensing. A couple of years ago, it was really unnerving because it was looking like for videos that were not made for profit that were under a certain length, you did not have to pay a licensing fee. If you were creating videos like over 4 minutes or 10 minutes long and you were making them for profit, for example, Twitch, you would have to pay a considerable annual fee, like tens of thousands of dollars, to license that codec. Not a big deal if you're Paramount or Fox or Disney or, you know, Pixar, who's now part of Disney, of course, et cetera, et cetera. Or if you're a gigantic, you know, company in, China or Thailand that's making Blu-ray players. However, if it's like Bob putting together an open source project, it gets really expensive. Mm-hmm. So, on one hand, I can see why they wouldn't put in MPEG-2 support, right? Because, you know, I don't think they were ever really looking at these for being a DVD player or a Blu-ray player, right? More importantly, right, because DVDs are last year and Blu-rays require HDCP compliance, which they're not going to get. An open source project is simply not going to get licensed for HDCP, at least not in any way that I think particularly likely. It's possible, but I wouldn't hold my breath. So in that sense, I would probably you know, I would probably be more irked, like, oh man, you know, I've downloaded 10,000 videos that are, you know, MKVs and I need my Mascarova support. And the Mascarova, the you know, is a container that can hold any of a number of different audio and video codecs inside of it. And it gets really complicated and it gets really hard to support all the codecs. For, you know, they chose the best, most efficient codec. They made it available. You can transcode to that codec from several commonly available server software so that your gigantic video collection, which you should be streaming from your server anyway, can transcode to H.264 on the device. And by the way, it's like a 0.1 release for a brand new piece of open source software that just hit. So would I like to see everything supported and everything available? Absolutely. Am I too worried about it? It's a freaking $25 to $35 toy. And I'm really excited to get my paws on one when the availability is around. So that's not a deal breaker for me.
Okay. Fair enough.
You know, maybe more laissez-faire about this than I should be. But,
obviously compared to this particular reader, so.
Absolutely. You know, it would be nice to have all the codecs supported, but I'll be honest with you, it's hard to get all the codecs supported on a Core i5, you know, Core i7 running Windows, because there's a lot of codecs out there. And true. Some of them get unbelievably complicated when they shouldn't be with their implementation. So I look forward to the support for multiple platforms growing in the future. But right now, I love H.264, and that's really what most of my collection is in. So maybe that's the other reason I'm not too upset about it.
We had another email. This was in the show notes from last week. I wasn't sure if you guys got to it since I wasn't here. The M11X.
I think we did, but it would be a good one to revisit because, let's get your perspective because we were looking at it, right? And at first it looked like they had shut down availability on it, but it turns out I found the one page at Dell that didn't actually have an open buying link. But Abraham's basically wants to know, he wants to buy an M11X, but he wants to know if he should buy it now or wait for the 2012 version to hit stores or hit Dell.com. Since this is not an urgent buy, I can afford to wait a few months. Also, I'm on the fence between this one and the MacBook Pro at the lower end. So the Alienware M11X, of course, is their little tiny gaming machine. It's about a year old at this point, but is a really nice piece of hardware, and actually relatively subtle by Alienware standards when you're looking at the design.
It is, yes. I would say, I guess it would depend on if you wanted the M11X because of that specific system. If you wanted an M11X because he wanted a light, easy to move around kind of mid-range gaming machine, in which case, you know, we talked about that Acer Aspire M3 that I don't think is a very good machine, but I think it is an indicative of what good machines will have in the not too distant future. You got to think about Ivy Bridge notebooks coming out with Kepler GPUs in Ultrabook form factors. And that to me is a pretty compelling combination for a mobile gamer type thing. You know, maybe I don't have to have an M17X with a 6990 in it that kind of burns my legs when I leave it on there to get a modest gaming experience out of it. So I would say I would wait. If I were him, I would wait, especially because the M11X, that model of it is long in the tooth. The hardware in it is right at the edge of doing it. And that's coming from me, who is typically not the kind of person that tells people to hold on and wait. I'm usually kind of the buy now type of thing.
Just get the notebook. You'll love it.
We have an email. Let's do the email from Paul about home streaming computer with older hardware. He says, I'm looking to set up a Windows Home Server machine and was wondering if one of the machines I've got lying around will suffice. It's a Core i3 second gen machine with 4 gigs of memory and onboard graphics and a 2 terabyte Western Digital Black hard drive. Will this be good enough for streaming video, or is the processor too weak?
Well, I was laughing because it's like whenever I see that, you know, is this old machine capable of being a server? Invariably, it's like a 90 megahertz Pentium, you know, or a first generation Athlon. Core i3 is a pretty powerful machine. Core i3 with 4 gigabytes of RAM and a 2 terabyte Western Digital Black. That is a lot of hardware for a home server. .. as long as you're not trying to transcode like your Blu-ray rips from ISOs into MPEG 2 for, you know, something on the other end of the network. Even then, though, this is a lot of power for a home server. It's actually, if you're not doing any transcoding or ripping of audio or video to store on your drive, it's probably incredibly overpowered. Because
you're basically, if it's a server, if you're just looking to stream data, the computer on the other end is going to have to do the decoding, right? So it's just pushing bits at that point, and that doesn't take hardly anything.
No, I mean, you could use an Atom for up to a certain point. You know, an Atom processor is going to handle just about anything a home network is going to throw at it. But a second gen Core i3 with 4 gigs of RAM and a black hard drive, that's going to do. You know, I don't see that getting into trouble, especially if it's got a, you know, gigabit Ethernet or attached to a gigabit network. I don't really see that get into trouble until you start doing a lot of, say, multiple HD streams simultaneously while transcoding like three of them. And even then, I mean, there's so much power in the Core i3 compared to earlier processors. I think you will be astonishingly happy. As a matter of fact, it's kind of funny. The computer I'm using right now is the home server, but it's got a Core i5 in it, which is way too much processor for that. But it's also sort of the fallback machine for when I need to do some work on the computer at home. And it's got enough power that I can rip Blu-rays and not have to wait around all day while the video is getting taken care of. So, yeah, you are golden, Paul. A Core Duo, a single Core Duo, a Core 2 Duo, even then I would say you have a lot of processing power you're working with, and you should have no trouble with that whatsoever.
I agree.
All right. That is it for this edition of Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware. Twitch at twit.tv is the email address. We love your questions. Keep sending them out to us. And so you're going to go home and go to sleep, or you're going to try to... burn through this, one I more GPU.
I tell you what, this graphics card is just staring me in the face the whole show, right? And I haven't even taken the tape off the edges, and I'm kind of like, man, maybe I should just plug it in and let's make sure it works. Do one run of 3D Mark or something like
that. Suddenly it's 4 a.m. and you're thinking about it.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what I think I don't want to get into that. And then, because then I want to set up and stream and people can watch, and it just, I'll probably go home. but other stuff coming up this week on PC Perspective. We're obviously going to do more testing with the 680. We're going to do SLI testing. We're going to do kind of more comprehensive multi-display testing, iFinity versus NVIDIA Surround. We did a little bit of that in the initial review, doing some 5760 by 1080 benchmarks, which are pretty interesting. And now that we have all this new space in the office, I don't have to like move displays around to set it up. We've already got a permanent 5760 by 1080 location for testing, which is nice.
Nice.
And then we also have maybe an answer from AMD. We have the MSI Radeon HD 7970 Lightning card, which is kind of one of these super over-engineered graphics cards from MSI that will have all kinds of overclocking headroom that we are hopefully have a review up later this week as well. So that's what's coming up on our side. Guess more GPUs, right? More GPUs. Z77 motherboards coming soon too. So keep an eye out for that.
Yeah, we've got World Backup Day is coming up at the end of the month, so we're doing an entire episode of Techzilla next week. On our Thursday episode is going to be all about backing up your system, backing up your system online, backing up your online to somewhere else, backing up your somewhere else to a third place. Basically, it's an all backup edition of Techzilla, and we're looking forward to that. It should be exciting. It's kind of funny, the idea that there's a World Backup Day. So we're actually going to be doing some video. It's going to be carried on the worldbackupday.com website. So I like the idea that Reddit spawned a World Backup Day. So
Reddit
can also spawn
just about anything, it would seem.
Yeah, but in a way that doesn't scare you as much as 4chan.
No, I agree 100%.
That's it for this edition of Twitch. I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Trout.
We'll see you next week on Twitch.